Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. You tell me.
This is Amy Alcon, and you're listening to Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in therapy and research. Now, for most of our lives, we've heard people talk about the self as if our brain is one big, rationally functional, unitary thing, but it actually seems to be comprised of a bunch of different, well, departments, kind of like in a company, accounting, shipping, and receiving. And sometimes one department doesn't know what the other is doing, and sometimes departments will act at cross purposes or do the wrong thing at the wrong time. It's really kind of crazy. Evolutionary psychologist Dr. Robert Kurzban is here to help us make sense of all of this. He's the author of a very interesting book, Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite, Evolution and the Modular Mind. Dr. Kurzban will explain how our mind's makeup makes us prone to hypocrisy and less than ideal behavior, and we'll even talk about ways maybe we can counteract it. Hello, Rob.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. This is important because basically we are all hypocrites, and you say actually that hypocrisy is a natural state of the human mind.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that it's a really nice way that you topped off the show by talking about these different parts. And sort of one of the things I think is important to bear in mind is that there are all these different little sub-yous in your head. And what that does is it gives rise to lots of different kinds of inconsistencies. And in particular, it gives rise to hypocrisy in this very natural way.
And you say that, you know, philosophers with this, you know, the way we thought of the mind with this very unitary view of the mind and the self, they get very hand-wringy about contradictions, but you're able to make more sense of them in looking at them in a different way. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that if you look in sort of the history of philosophy, but also in psychology, and even in our sort of intuitive interactions in real life, we have this sense that there's a me and I have beliefs. And if I have a belief, it sort of spreads out into my entire head. But I think there's a different way of looking at it, which is that there's different parts of your head, and different parts have one belief, and those beliefs might be different from the belief that another part has. I mean, it seems sort of intuitively strange, but I think that advances in cognitive science, because they're helping to explain how it is that there's really all these different components of the mind, is helping us to understand how the mind can be sort of pulling us in different directions at the very same time.
And you call these modules. So explain what a module is.
Yeah, so a module really just means something that has a particular job. I mean, one way to think about the omnipresent applications on your phones these days is like a little module. So you might have a module that you use to send text messages. You might have a module that you use to, I don't know, throw birds into buildings with pigs in them to keep track of the weather and so on. And your brain's the same way. It has little bits and pieces that have jobs. That's not to say that each of these things with a job is in a particular location in your head. Parts of the mind that have jobs can be spread out all over the brain. But the important thing that I mean when I'm talking about a module is something with a job, you know, something that might be responsible for seeing or moving a part of the body or making certain kinds of decisions. That's really the intuition.
Well, why is it important to understand that we're talking about function and not structure?
Right, because as you said at the top of your show, I'm an evolutionary psychologist. And from the standpoint of evolution, what really matters is function. Of how the machine in question, whether it's part of physiology or part of the mind, how it does its job. And so for me, what I really care about is, you know, understanding what the different jobs are going on by the little mechanisms in your head.
And now, give us the evidence for the modular mind, because many, many people for many years have believed in this unitary self, and this is relatively new thinking, the modular mind.
Yeah, so I think that many people are willing to sort of grant that there's functional specificity, that is modularity at the low level. So, you know, everyone looks at if you look at a retina, the retina has these cells, and all they do is they detect light waves, right? They detect electromagnetic radiation. And so people are willing to say, oh, yeah, there's specialization at that level. But there's other levels, too. So, for example, we now know that there's different memory systems. So there's parts of your mind that are good at storing facts. things that you've learned. And then there's other parts of your mind that are good at storing episodes, that is things that have happened to you. And those are different. They have different jobs. And because they have different jobs, they have to work sort of differently. And then, you know, the advance I think that we've seen in the last 20, 30 years is sort of to say, you know what, this idea of specificity, this idea that there's these little agents doing very specific jobs, it really goes all the way up. It goes all the way up to working memory and to the social functions of the mind and to morality. So it's not just photoreceptors and vision and memory. It's the things that make us, the things that make us social creatures navigating the social world.
So basically what you're saying is that we don't so much have beliefs as we do have modules that hop up or don't hop up, you know, depending on what the environment is and what the problem we're facing is.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, again, it sort of feels very much like we each have our own beliefs and that we're in control of the show. But again, the lesson I think from a lot of the research in psychology is that there's all this stuff going on in your head, helping you make decisions, helping you make choices, make inferences, and we often don't really know about them. And which ones sort of come to mind, as it were, does depend exactly as you're saying on the context you find ourselves in. So, you know, you see a bear and all of a sudden your system is designed to get you away from bears are active. You see someone who's attractive of the opposite sex and then a different set of modules are active. So it's very context specific.
Well, but you write about also how, you know, we can mix up what behavior should be in a situation. You give, there's this wonderful example at the beginning of your book. You say, ignorance can save your life in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that is one of my favorite examples. It's sort of, you know, I think having come from California, where I think you are, you know, you get very used to people stopping when you try to cross the street. At least that was my experience in Southern California. In Philadelphia, that wasn't my experience. And what I found is that when people can see that you've seen them coming, they tend to go through the intersection secure in the knowledge that you can escape because you've seen them. Right? So what you do is if you keep your eyes directed on your cell phone or across the intersection or on the person you're talking to, then the oncoming drivers, they think that you haven't seen them, and so they slow down because, you know, they'd rather not hit you given that you can't escape. So there's a case in which, you know, not knowing the person's coming actually helps you because it changes the behavior of the other person. And that's the important point, is that my ignorance can change your best move. And so by being ignorant, sometimes we actually can make ourselves better off.
And actually, I would say this is appearing to be ignorant. I actually just wrote about this in my next book that is going out now to publishers. And I learned about this in Rome, and this seemed like the craziest thing. My friend Tomas said, you don't look at them when you cross the street. You just look straight. They're such crazy drivers. I thought, I'll be dead. But sure enough, they stopped. And what I found actually was that when you walk down the sidewalk and there are, you know, six people walking abreast, if you don't make eye contact with them, they will avoid you. Otherwise, they expect you to leap into traffic. And it's so amazing. So it's really, that's how one of the ways, and you show some in your book, you know, that you can hack the modular mind by, you know, appearing to be ignorant instead of actually being ignorant.
Yeah, so appearances does all the work here. And it goes the reverse too, Amy, right? So if I'm ignorant but the other person doesn't know it, then I'm actually no better off, right? So, you know, the classic example of the game of chicken where, you know, if I want you to swerve, then I just throw the steering wheel out the window, and then you can, you know, try to finesse that by putting a blindfold on. But the problem is if I don't see your blindfold, then I don't know that you can't see me coming, right? And so it's really important that it's exactly as you say, the appearances are key here. You really want to ensure that the other person knows you're ignorant or it's not going to work. And this is why you see signs in places like convenience stores that says, you know, clerk does not know the combination. It's not, you know, it's not useful for the clerk not to have the notification unless a potential thief knows that the clerk is ignorant and can't, you know, coerce, the thief can't coerce the code out of the attendant.
And actually, I love reading that example of the playing chicken and throwing the steering wheel out. And I thought, wouldn't it be smart to go to a junkyard and get extra steering wheels, you know, to be able to fool, again, to hack the modular mind.
Right, exactly. So there's all these. This is the problem with ignorance: is that knowledge is easy to demonstrate, ignorance can be difficult to demonstrate. And so, you know, and I think that's an important point: is that because we're all playing games with each other, we're all in these interesting interactions with one another. I have to bear in mind that sometimes it's hard. So, you know, I always think about a little bit the Dustin Hoffman film where he keeps being asked, "Is it safe? Is it safe?" And in that particular scene, I hope I'm not ruining it for any of your listeners. Right? He really wants to try to demonstrate that he doesn't know the answer to the question. that's what's going to keep them safe. But it's hard to demonstrate ignorance, and that I think is one of the things that makes this area so interesting.
Yeah, that's actually Marathon Man, one of my favorite films, and I think it came out when I was five. So I think that it's, you know, the spoilers are long past given out. So one thing I'd like to explain, because you're an evolutionary psychologist, and I should do a little station ID. I'm talking with Dr. Robert Kurzban, who is the author of a very interesting book, Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite. We're talking about how our mind's makeup makes us prone to hypocrisy and less than ideal behavior and ways we can counteract that. You can call in to comment, to ask advice, or to ask a question, 347-326-9761. That's 347-326-9761. And this is something really fascinating to me. I wanted to ask you about what an evolutionarily novel environment is, if I can say it, an evolutionarily novel environment, and how that causes us problems.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A colleague of mine just showed me this really interesting paper, and it's about a species of marmot, and the wolves that used to predate upon them have gone extinct. And so in the marmot's evolutionary history, wolves were a recurrent feature of the environment. And so what you do is if you put cardboard cutouts of these predators that no longer exist, in these marmot environments, they still run away from them. And the idea here is that there's a change in the ecology in which the organism evolved. They have all these mechanisms in their head designed for the world in which they evolved over the course of their evolutionary history, and the current world is different. So, you know, in our human ancestral environments, there were much lower population densities. We didn't have cities. We didn't have iPads. We didn't have hamburgers. We had a very different sort of world. And so, you know, the idea here is this disconnect between what is the mind designed to experience, right? So what was our evolutionary history like? And what's the modern environment like? And you can sort of start to think about the ways in which those two things are very different.
Well, one example for me is sugar, that, you know, in the evolutionary environment, we were running around in loincloths, there were no 7-Elevens, you know, that it would have been really advantageous and smart to grab the berries off the bush when you found them, and now we still have the same taste for sugar, and you can go to Costco and bring home, you know, a dump truck full of Twinkies. So that's no longer useful because it's an evolutionarily novel environment. Our brains are perfect for 1.8 million years ago when there were just 5 berries on a bush and not, you know, 5 cases of Twinkies in our trunk.
Exactly. And I think the food examples are very well taken, is that, you know, we have this world, we have a market economy in which we can get large calorie packages for very small amounts of effort, which, as you're saying, is exactly different from the world our ancestors experienced. And so, yeah, we take advantage of those opportunities and often to our detriment.
Right. And actually, I love, you just remind me of Daniel Fessler's study with the eyes. You know, and you talked about this a bit in your book with Eyes on You. And his study, I think, said that, you know, and listen up, all of you who work in coffee bars, that if you do things like put a picture of eyes above a tip jar, you increase tips, you know, because it was important to us to see eyes. But now, you know, it sort of plays tricks on us.
Yeah, exactly. So all these little cues around us really have an important effect on our psychology. I myself have this. So my research when I was a graduate student, in fact, my dissertation work was a similar sort of thing. I had people play a sharing game and had people match eye gazes with one another. And the idea, again, would be, you know, maybe our minds are designed for a world in which reputations matter, and matching eye gazes stimulates you to be a bit more cooperative. And that's sort of what I found. So I think bearing in mind the way in which our minds are designed to respond to these different environmental cues, I think it's potentially really important.
I found that research actually really interesting. This was what was called a public goods game. And can you explain what that is a little bit?
Yeah, so a public goods game is one in which you have a number of different players and they have an amount of money to start with, called an endowment, and they really just have a really simple choice. They can keep all the money or they can put some of the money in a central pot, which then gets multiplied by some number, let's say 2, and shared with everyone. So one way to think about it is it's sort of a way to measure how generous I'm being with a particular group. To what extent do I put the money in my pocket, and to what extent do I put it in the middle, making it more valuable to share with everyone else? And so these tools have been around for quite a long time to explore various facets of our cooperative psychology.
Right. And but the thing about the eyes, in one condition of the study, you had the subjects just take a little peek at each other, and that seemed to change things, whether they were cooperative or selfish jerks, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what I did is I had them sort of match oblique eye gazes with each other, so sort of in your mind, picture two people out of the corner of their eye looking at each other in a kind of conspiratorial glance. And as you're saying, what we did is we did that, and people who did that wound up putting more money in the pot than people who didn't, as though the exchanging these little brief glances made them feel more cooperative or maybe more groupish with one another.
Well, you and I are both interested in the moral emotions and everything, and for me, you know, I look a lot at reputation, and probably I would guess that that was triggering our concerns about our reputation and other people, you know, how other people see us and how we see them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think one of the really strong things about the ideas that you have been introducing is, you know, these cases of people who in some ways aren't as aren't thinking as carefully about their reputation as they should. Right. So one way to think about the rudeness that you identify in so many fascinating anecdotes is to sort of think of them as, you know, here are cases in which people are imposing costs, you know, in the form of externalities, you know, things, side effects of what they're doing without really worrying about how the people they're affecting, you know, think about them. And I think this is a, you know, relatively big problem in the modern world in which, you know, in some sense, people aren't as concerned about their reputations as maybe they ought to be.
Right. And this is the stuff I write about in I See Rude People in my next book, How We Live in Societies Too Big for Our Brains. This is based on the work of anthropologist Robin Dunbar and his measurement of the human neocortex and his feeling that we can, you know, basically live in societies of about 150 people. That's the upward end. You know, and this is an estimate, but there's all this evidence that societies were that size, and that appears in many places in human history because we seem to need the constraints of people we know around us to be accountable. And if we're around strangers, we can just be jerks if we're jerks.
Yeah, I totally. And I think this is a really interesting feature of the modern world in which, you know, I do think that back in the past, probably being a jerk would have carried more cost, at least being a jerk to the people who were supposedly on your side or in your little coalition or alliance.
Right, right. As I put it, yeah, before people had rubber-soled shoes and Motel 6s. I mean, because you get thrown out of your tribe back in the Pleistocene, and you were in some serious trouble if you didn't have other people to cooperate with and finding food and everything and taking care of each other.
Right, exactly.
I should do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Tonight's brain belongs to evolutionary psychologist Dr. Robert Kurzban, author of Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite, Evolution and the Modular Mind. Very, very interesting book that I highly recommend. We're talking about hypocrisy, how our mind's makeup makes us prone to it, and what we can do about it. Call in to comment, to ask for advice, or to ask a question, 347-326-9761. That's 347-326-9761. I love this example you give in your book, contrasting a toaster with a butane torch for making your toast. Both can be used to toast bread, of course, you know, but one is better than the other. And you talk a bit about how specialization is good and bad.
Yeah, although I have to admit, mostly good. So the nice thing about specialization is that it builds efficiency. So although there is a downside, right, so more specialized things in some sense wind up having only a narrower set of uses. But the nice thing about specialization, and this is for all the tools that we have around, and it's for the little, as we were talking about earlier, the little applications on your phone. I mean, the key thing in engineering is that when you increase specialization, you increase the efficiency with which you can solve a problem. So if your problem is turning a piece of bread into a piece of toast, you know, it's really nice to have a toaster, which puts the elements right next to the bread and has the heat being applied relatively uniformly. A blowtorch wouldn't really do as good a job, although it is it's a mechanism for applying heat to something. It's just not specialized for doing that special thing that we want to have done to bread to turn it into toast. No, you can couldn't use a toaster to weld or whatever it is you use a blowtorch for. And the point here, of course, is that, you know, that different jobs require different specialized mechanisms to do them.
The problem is, though, how does our mind work in terms of we see, okay, there's a problem. How do we identify it as the right problem, or how do we misidentify it?
Right, and that's a great question, and it's also a complicated one. So this is one way I sort of think about the emotions. The emotions are ways to identify exactly what situation you're in, what the challenge is, or what the opportunity is to motivate the appropriate behavior. I mean, the thing about a phone is that, you know, the user decides what applications to make to be active, but your brain doesn't have the advantage of a user, so it has to figure out for itself what's going to be relevant. So, you know, you see a charging bear, and that stimulates the emotion of fear, which stimulates the behavioral response. You know, it gets the adrenaline rush, and it gets you moving away. Same thing if you see someone of an appropriate age and sex for your particular preferences and so on. That might activate different psychological mechanisms and get those things going on. And so, you know, the tricky thing about building a brain is that it has to figure out how what it needs to do at each particular moment. And again, as I said, I think emotions are a good way to think about that. So they sort of are, you know, these high-level programs that get us moving in the right direction, get us thinking about the relevant things for the particular environment we find ourselves.
But fight or flight hormones that you know are activated when you see the bear, you know, sometimes they're activated because the neighbor's kid jumps out at you and you've got that cortisol surging and it's for the wrong reason. Is there any way to sort of edit ourselves when our modules go awry?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult problem, and there's always this issue with sort of course correction. And, you know, the short answer to that is, I think so, but I also think it's going to turn out to be complicated. And I also think there's these interesting ways in which we do it to ourselves. I mean, I've been thinking recently a little bit about horror movies and how you think about fear and horror and terror as a subversive state, and yet, you know, we spend something coming up to $500 million a year on going into movies and basically scaring ourselves. Maybe I shouldn't be poo-pooing this from someone out in Hollywood land out there where movies
are. Oh, no.
Actually,
I'd love to know why people see them, because I can't see them. I can't see horror movies or war movies, and I have no idea why anyone wants to watch them.
Yeah, no, this is an interesting puzzle. I've been sort of thinking about it a little bit. But what it suggests is, of course, that, I mean, one thing that it suggests is that not only can our systems be fooled, right, just like your example of the neighbor's kid, you know, on a skateboard or whatever it is, but then we sort of try to fool ourselves. That is to say, some modules are causing other modules to experience fear or what have you. And I think that's all really interesting. And I think it illustrates this idea that, you know, one way to think about it is that psychology is all very local. We're really affected by what's happening in our sensory experience. And that's because, again, you have these evolved systems that are designed to navigate you around in the particular immediate environment you find yourself.
I love the way you just described that. Psychology is all very local. It's fascinating. I would love to know, why are we sometimes unable to identify the reason for our choices? And you give the great pantyhose example for this.
Yeah, so this is an old study back in the 70s by a couple of psychologists at the University of Michigan who were interested in looking at people's choice behavior. And the short version is that they gave people an identical set of pantyhose. They asked people to choose, and they were identical. So the researchers knew that the reason for the choice couldn't be a property of the pantyhose. But if you ask subjects, you know, why did you choose the ones they did, they always pointed to a particular property. Well, the texture or the color. And what that suggests, I mean, they're not lying. These are sincere subjects. They're not trying to dissemble it from the experimenter. The trick is that the system in your head that does the choosing just isn't accessible to the part of you that does the talking. You know, I think of there being sort of a press secretary in your head, and this is an idea that philosopher Daniel Dennett has articulated, and others have had similar ideas as well, that you sort of have a spokesperson for the mind, something that moves the vocal cords and so on. And the problem is that the decision-making modules are not necessarily always properly giving information to the decision to the speaking modules. So it's perfectly normal, and this goes all the way back, of course, to people like Freud who talked about the subconscious. It's just that, and recently we've had, a better way to talk about it. And so the idea is this, that you have these decision-making systems in your head, the things that are actually doing the decision-making work, and then you have the talking system, and they don't always, you know, link up to one another.
Actually, you have this fantastic example at the beginning of chapter 4 using the West Wing and, you know, talking about exactly the press secretary from that show and how it was very important for her to remain ignorant of some of the information. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think this is, the show captures, as it so often did, captures what's really going on in the political world, which is that if there was a piece of information that would be damaging to the administration if it were known, the problem is that the press secretary knows it, then if he's asked, he either has to lie about it, which would be bad for the press secretary, or admit it, which would be bad for the administration. So if there's some embarrassing fact or some, you know, something that it more generally would be damaging if the press and therefore the public knew about it. So if the press secretary can remain ignorant of that fact, if he or she is carefully kept away from knowledge, then when the press asks him or her, he can sincerely say, I don't know. And what that does is it prevents him from having to lie, and it also, which can be caught and then eventually prosecuted, and it also prevents the information from being leaked. So it's a weird fact that in many cases, the individual who's tasked with, you know, putting information out into the world can actually be better off without these big packets of information.
Right. And I know you don't like the term self-deception. You think we should do away with that and the term self-control. But just to use us for a second, it is so helpful. And Robert Trevor's talked about this last month, you know, that in order to deceive others, it's very helpful to deceive ourselves. We need to start there. Then we're more believable when we're deceiving others if we actually believe the stuff or think we're telling the truth. And it sort of seems to dovetail with what you're saying.
Yeah, so Bob and I agree in broad strokes on this. We disagree about some of the details. So what I would say is that, that more or less the way to think about that is you just want to keep the key information out of the modules that might leak it into the world, again, as sort of the press secretary systems. But he's basically right. I think he's right about that if you believe the issue that we talked about at the top of the show, the advantage of ignorance and various kinds of strategic games that we play with one another, if you believe that, then absolutely, then not having that information so you can sincerely, you know, take a position that's at least plausible and you know, good for you, as opposed to, you know, displaying something that's bad for you, I think that's probably right.
Now, you talk about, you have this great term, no computation without representation. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, it's obviously a little riff on no taxation without representation, but and I think I stole that. I'm pretty sure that there's a paper by Larry Finnick, a guy who was in the lab with me when I was at Santa Barbara. I'm 99% sure that I lifted that right from a paper that he wrote. But the idea there is that in order to have beliefs and desires in your head, you need to have these things, which in cognitive science are called representations, which are basically just data structures. And so the idea that I'm trying to get across there is that when you're thinking about the computations that your head, your brain performs, there has to be some data structure in there. There has to be some representation of information. And I think that this is something that people don't always think all that much about, just because the way that psychology is often done, it's not very computational. And I just wanted to work in. I know that you had Roy Baumeister on your show not too long ago, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about that. But I think that the sort of ideas that he talked about would be, I think, more profitably approached if people started thinking about what's going on computationally instead of using the metaphor of a muscle or a resource.
Oh, we're going to talk about that, because I agree more with your idea of the reward model of self-control. And I wish I could maybe I'll put you guys together. Greg's trying to have me avoid being the scientific version of Bill O'Reilly. So let's talk also about strategic ignorance. For example, people who don't get tested by STDs, there are reasons. People, it's in their self-interest to involve these things. There are sort of immoral things that are going on, thanks to the modules.
Yeah, so one of the examples that I like to use about this, I talk about a certain ex-governor of New York and the hypocrisy where, I think there's these moral systems in your head, which are basically, one way to think about them is the little systems that are designed to identify what other people are doing wrong that violate the rules. And then there's these separate systems in your head which cause you to pursue, those things which you sort of want to pursue. So you might, tell the public that you're opposed to prostitution, you're going to prosecute people engaged in it, and that's good, right? It's good to be seen as the moralistic hero, the individual who is, involved in punishing people for their various moral transgressions. And then you have a certain motivational system that maybe would cause you to engage in that very thing, and so you get these contradictions. In terms of strategic ignorance, this goes back to the discussion of chicken that we talked about earlier, which is that, if you don't notice that there's these inconsistencies in your own behavior, then it's a little bit easier to, reduce the chance that other people are going to notice it. And I think that's the important point, is that if I don't notice my own inconsistencies, just like a press secretary who doesn't know what's going on that's potentially damaging, then it becomes a little bit easier for me to conceal that, not conceal in the sense of lies, but actually just not leak that into the world.
Right, to be conveniently dense.
Exactly. So again, strategic ignorance, I think is a nice way to think about it, because what it's basically saying is, I'm not going to know about stuff when not knowing about stuff gives me an advantage in my dealings with the various other people who are in my world.
Now, we have a question from last week that Jim P. in the chat room has brought up. I had on last week Dr. Ofer Zur, who has very politically incorrect views on victims and victimization, and his grandparents actually died in the Holocaust. And what he asked, and he didn't really answer, was why, you know, when there were maybe five guards for 200 prisoners, why in the Holocaust did, you know, people in the camps not attack the guards? And I don't know if you have an answer to that, but I thought I would see if there's some kind of modular mind view that you can speculate on as to why that might have happened.
Well, I mean, that's a little bit outside of my domain of expertise, but I do think that, you know, one way to think about that, the regime, is that it was a very amoral regime. I'm not saying it's an immoral regime. I'm saying it's an amoral regime. That is, the rules of the social behavior in Nazi Germany were very much about power. And the people who had power, basically, you know, they could do pretty much what they wanted, not constrained by the rules of the game, or at least not seriously constrained by the rules of the game. And that's the crucial thing about morality. When we all agree what the moral rules are, then, you know, then you can imagine that when people break them, we all get together and we gang up on that individual. But in the context of a regime in which, you know, morality isn't the way that we decide conflicts and decide who's gonna be punished and who's going to, you know, not be. You know, so in those regimes, it just wasn't the way that you settled things. The moral rule was basically whoever has the physical power, the coercive power, does what they want without punishment. And so, you know, that was, you know, unfortunately, that was the regime under which people were operating. And so, you know, someone who attacked the guards, you know, a German citizen or a camp victim, they would be pretty unlikely to get support because it just wasn't an ecology in which the way that people decided what to do was by consulting their moral compass. It was by consulting who had the guns, who had the authority in that particular situation.
Yeah, I guess on this. Oh, sorry. What did you? I didn't mean to interrupt you. Okay. Well, my thinking, actually, just looking at this, was that German Jews, and just a tiny tangent, they become very wealthy and successful, and for the first time in a long time in Europe, were part of society, and I think that they couldn't believe that they weren't part, and they couldn't believe this was happening to them because of how well they had done, and that's sort of my speculation on it, but I don't have an answer. It's just speculation.
Yeah, I don't consider myself an expert on this.
Yeah, sorry to spring that on you, but you're smart,
no.
So I tried. I wanted to ask you the very, very interesting stuff in your book, Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite. I'm talking to Dr. Robert Kurzban, evolutionary psychologist. It's on how the modular view changes how we view decision-making. You wrote about Benjamin Libet's research on things like moving the wrist. That's fascinating about how that happens in our mind.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, one way to think about decisions, even simple ones like moving a finger, moving your wrist, is really, you don't want to think about it in terms of, you know, the inner me making the choice. You want to think about it as this whole cascade of decisions that get made. So at some point, there's some module that, you know, decides to move your hand. There's going to be another module that then sends that information to the somatosensory cortex or the motor cortex, and then that module is going to send the signal down to your hand. And the crucial part there is that, you know, the thing that we experience of ourselves is not necessarily the first module in that chain. So if you believe what we were talking about earlier in terms of the study with the pantyhose, the decision-making system is often, you know, not the conscious mind that's doing it. It's this non-conscious stuff, and that's the first part in this chain. And then it's only after these modules have made this decision that the experiencing I am aware of it. Then that explains why it seems in those studies that the decision is made before the person is aware of it, because awareness is only one part of the chain. It's this whole little sequence, this little, you know, train, which is being started at one point by this one little module, and then somewhere consciousness occurs, and then the action occurs after that.
Another fascinating thing in your book was something that another guest talked about. I had on Dr. Barry Schwartz, who wrote this wonderful book, The Paradox of Choice. And, you know, one of the ways the mind messes us up that you wrote about in terms of his work is, you know, how we keep gathering information when it isn't worth our time. We spend all this time, you know, for example, and I learned from his show, I went to Las Vegas for the stupid conference, not stupid, but it was a conference, and I had to eat at this little deli, you know, and I went there and I realized I could just find the first thing on the menu I liked, Philadelphia cheesesteak, and I ate that at every meal. I didn't look at the menu because what if I like a hamburger 3% better. The amount of time I put in, I mean, it's just, you realize that from understanding psychology, how you're costing yourself. And can understanding the mind as modular, as, you know, having all these little departments, can it help us avoid, you know, these things like this that are so irrational in terms of how we're spending our time?
Yes, first I just want to thank you for the plug of the cheesesteak, obviously our favorite city food here. And, you know, it's interesting also, so I just saw Barry Schwartz is just down the road here, also just outside of Philadelphia, Swarthmore. So I've had a nice chance to interact with him. And I think that, you know, thinking about those issues, yeah, I guess one way to kind of reflect on it is that you have all these modules in your head and they're hungry for different things in the metaphorical sense, right? So some of them want to seek out things to eat. Some of them want to seek out information. Some of them want to seek out, you know, images of various people. And I do think that being aware of that can be helpful. So you say, okay, well, there's some module in my head and it wants to sort of figure out what just the best food is or the best deal. It could possibly be. And those modules, you know, they don't have the big picture. They don't see that there's always going to be trade-offs. And that's the key issue, is that, you know, the time you spend figuring out if you did want the cheesesteak, which of course you did, as opposed to the other kind of, you know, the food options, that's time that could be spent doing other things. And I think that, for me, has been the most helpful way to think about modularity, is that, you know, these modules have their own agenda, and it's possible that they could be short-circuited in part by saying, look, I don't have to give in to this module. I can, you know, just make this choice. I can use some relatively simple decision rule and go that way and then spend my time on more important things.
Right. And you talk about in your book something that Baumeister did and also Barry Schwartz did, you know, about, you know, we have this conflict between satisfying immediate versus long-term needs. And you talk about context-dependent preferences. What does that mean?
Right. So, you know, I think the real natural way to think about this is, you know, people go to the grocery store when they're hungry and they tend to purchase things, well, they purchase more things, first of all, but they tend to purchase things which have lower processing times, things that they can eat very quickly. And what that means basically is that the context that one finds oneself in influences your decision making. So if you're in a context in which you're hungry, then you're going to do the things that satisfy hunger quickly. There's this really nice work by Dan Ariely, who I don't know if you've had on your show, but he shows that if you get people sexually aroused and then you give them a bunch of different questionnaires, I don't know how he gets his stuff by the review board, the ethics committee, but he does. He's a genius in that way and so many others. You get people who are aroused and they say yes to surprising questions about what they would be willing to do in terms of their sexual behaviors and some of their, you know, other kinds of behaviors. And I think the idea there is that, look, you have these minds and they're in these bodies and the decision-making depends on the state that the body finds itself in. So if it's aroused, it's going to do X, Y, or Z. If it's hungry, it's going to do A, B, or C. And so, you know, controlling the context when you're making a decision. This is why people tell you not to go to the grocery store hungry. It's because it's going to change your buying decisions. And I think it's good advice.
Well, actually, you have this great quote in that section. I love it. And people don't tell you to avoid the grocery store when you're sexually aroused, which is just so funny. And I wanted to ask you about whether there can be spillover, you know, like in Daly and Wilson's study of attractive women and male spending. Can one sort of short-term desire spill over into another area?
Yeah, I think it can. I just want to be a little cautious here because that question sort of starts to dart ahead of the research. And those kinds of questions are going to be figured out on sort of a case-by-case basis. When does this spill over? When does it not? You know, the thing you mentioned about the being aroused in a grocery store is sort of saying, look, you know, you do make these short-term decisions in the context of the Ariely study. So maybe people would do things that are short-term pleasing but long-term bad once they're sexually aroused. But that's in the domain of sexuality, not in the domain of food choice. I don't think it's going to be true that you would prefer, you know, donuts to an apple when you're sexually aroused as opposed to when you're hungry. But it could be. I mean, as you say, things do spill over. So, I mean, I think that's a great question. And I also kind of believe that as additional research gets done in this area, that's going to be the kind of thing that we get better at answering.
Yeah, and you did make that clear in your book, and I should do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. Tonight's brain belongs to evolutionary psychologist Dr. Robert Kurzban, coming to you from the home of Philly Cheesesteak. And he is author of Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite, Evolution in the Modular Mind. You can call in to comment, ask for advice, or ask a question, 347-326-9761. That's 347-326-9761. Or you can also ask one in our chat room. And since you are a professor at Penn, I should say Advice Goddess Radio is a proud sponsor of Campus Civil Liberties Defenders of Fire.org. Please check out the great work they do to defend free of charge anybody on campus who gets their rights violated. And if you have a few dollars rolling around, you can please consider sending them Fire's way. So I want to know, I want to talk about outsmarting our modules, and I want to talk about discount rates in humans. And you say we have different discount rates with respect to different choices. So first, I guess, can you explain what the discount rate is in you know, vis-a-vis human behavior?
Yeah, so the easiest way to think about it would be, you know, just answer the question, would you rather have $10 today or $11 tomorrow? And the answer to that question gives you your discount rate. If you'd rather have the money today rather than tomorrow, then you have a high discount rate. And if you'd rather have the, if you're willing to wait for tomorrow to have a slightly larger amount of money, then you have a lower discount rate. And you ask economists and discount rates in general for many different things that people do are a little bit steep. That is, we tend to be impatient, right? So we tend to want to take the money now. We tend to want to have the high carbohydrate food now instead of having the more healthy option. I know that this is one of the things that you've also talked about is carbohydrates, so I thought I'd work that in there. Right. So different modules have different discount rates, right? So you have these different modules in your head which sort of want to consume stuff right now, and then you have these more patient modules, the ones that are inhibiting your short-term decisions, and these things are in conflict. And I think that's one of the really interesting areas. Again, you sort of alluded to this earlier, is that, you know, humans have this tough problem where they've got to figure out, should I take the reward that's ahead of me, which maybe in the long run would be bad, or should I be patient and avoid this, you know, tempting treat or sexual opportunity or opportunity to watch a television show instead of going for the famous Broad Street Run, which occurred today in Philadelphia? You know, you have to make these tough decisions.
And you actually, you write about something Roy Baumeister did, the famous marshmallow study, where kids who resisted the marshmallow, you know, they waited, that those kids did better, in life in terms of their self-control. And what I'm wondering is, you know, are there ways we can increase our self-control? But I guess I'm getting a little ahead of myself. So let's go. I'm going to back up and say, I want to just say that you disagree with Baumeister's notion that willpower is a muscle. How do you view willpower?
Right. So I think that, the thinking about willpower is a sort of, it's not a productive way to think about it. The way I sort of think about these sorts of decisions is that whenever you're making a decision in the kinds of tasks that we're talking about, so, you know, Walter Mischel's famous marshmallow task that you alluded to, or let's say one of these a Stroop tasks where you have to look at a word. Let's say the word is blue, but it's in red ink, and you've got to say the word that names the color as opposed to the word that the letters spell. That there's always this sort of opportunity cost. What else could you be doing? So you're not eating marshmallows. Basically, the cost is, you know, the satisfaction that you would get from eating a marshmallow. When you're doing a Stroop task, you can't devote your attention to all the other sorts of things that you could be thinking about, what you're going to eat for dinner, all sorts of other things.
Let me just say that Stroop task is some cognitively tiring task. Like you're saying, they spell out blue, but it's written in red, and yeah, and I just wanted to, I forgot to mention that Baumeister, when he says willpower functions as a muscle, he means it gets worn out from too much use, but I think that your view, to me, from what I've read in the research, makes much more sense.
Well, thanks. I hope so. So our view would be not that it gets worn out, but is that it's tallying up the cost. So every time you persist in these tasks, the cost of all the things you're not doing goes up. So you can kind of think about this as, you know, why would you persist if the current task is not rewarding in some way, given that you could be doing something that is rewarding? And I think about this like foraging. So if you have a squirrel and it's in a patch and it's getting a bunch of nuts, you can imagine that as those nuts get reduced in frequency, it feels maybe more frustrating for the squirrel. I'm not trying to say what it's like to be a squirrel. I'm just using I don't know what it's like to be a squirrel. But, you know, you might imagine that if you're a squirrel and you're eating these nuts and you can't get a nut, it's like, oh, this is frustrating. So what does that mean? That's basically natural selection's way of saying you should go to a different patch of nuts. You should do something else with your time. So you should spend, you know, you should you should go to another patch and then start foraging there. And that's what I think is going on in these tasks, is that people are getting information that the thing they're doing is not particularly valuable, right? So they're not getting rewarded for it. There's no incentives frequently. And so, but it is effortful, and that by that I mean it's something like it recruits these, you know, really fancy systems in your head, like working memory and the attention system and the executive function and so on. And those can all be used for other things. So I think, yeah, as you're saying, I don't think it's going to turn out that a resource view is going to be particularly helpful. I think that the more useful way to think about this is going to be, you know, effort is natural selection's way of saying, unless you have a really good reason for doing what you're doing, probably it's time to switch tasks.
Right. Well, and you put it so beautifully and simply in your book, Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite. You talk about cost, the ratio of cost to reward, and the word reward is very important. And when I read this chapter, I think I emailed you right away in the middle of the night. I love how you laid out that food reward helped, and it led me to think of Randy Nassi's depression is low mood hypothesis. And his idea is that if you're chipping away at a tree and looking to get to the stake inside, and you don't find the stake and you keep chipping, if you weren't living in, you know, 1.8 million years ago, you would have died looking for the steak. So you needed to have something to bring you down, to make you stop doing the frustrating thing. And so from reading your chapter, I got this very practical thing. Reading your chapter, and then a woman named Emily Deans, who I'll have on the show eventually, she's a psychiatrist with an evolutionary foundation. She talked about ketones for the brain, which is basically if you eat meat fat, it rewards your brain. And so when I'm on deadline, it's terribly stressful. I will sometimes even go in the refrigerator and eat a pat of butter around noon when it's like my brain's about to be on fire, because this gives me some kind of reward. And this is just, you know, a hypothesis and everything, but it actually, I mean, my experience, the, you know, the control group of one, you know, is that it seems to work and it seems to make sense, you know, that you can sort of give yourself these little presents in order to increase your cognitive energy, presence from sleep to food to somebody telling you you're great, you know, that they like your whatever, and those really seem to help in self-control.
Yeah, those are great examples, and I think that what you've just said really ties very closely to the research, where if you give people these little rewards, they can persist. And I think that what you're identifying is a really important point with respect to this kind of resource view, because if you had the resource view, then these little things shouldn't increase self-control, because it doesn't increase the resource. What you're saying is, you know, you reward people, you incentivize them in some way, you give them some sense that what they're doing is good, then they're going to persist on doing it. And I really love this study that came out a number of years ago, or I guess it's like a couple, where they found the same thing in the context of exercise. So you put people in a recumbent bike or a stationary bike, I should say, and you give them some sugar solution, and they spit it out. So they're not getting more calories. They spit it out. But they get the reward sensation in their mouth of getting this nice beverage, and they can actually increase their output in terms of their bicycle performance. So what that suggests is that what we should be looking at here are things like reward when we're trying to understand how people can persist, not looking at something like some kind of mysterious resource that's just swishing around in your head somewhere.
Right, and that's the thing. I love to make all the science very practical, and that's something that's helped me a lot. That, and also, you know, when we had Barry Schwartz on, we talked about, you know, how costly choices are and having to make a lot of choices. And so I realized all the ways in my life, like by eating the exact same breakfast every day, I don't go in the refrigerator and say, I wonder if I should have yogurt. I have 3 strips of bacon and a greasy cheese omelet every single day of my life. It's very important. And so this is a way to not deplete myself. So I don't need a reward at 9. I might need one at 12, you know. And you see that. And if you start doing that, I think people should try this. Practice. Give yourself rewards for the stuff you're doing, you know. Get to give yourself a, you know, a snack at this time and that time and that time, and make it meat fat, because although Baumeister talks in his book about sugar, you know, glucose solution, and you wrote about his research too, it seems to be from the research on you know, what makes your blood sugar go up and down, what's really you know, the most helpful for reward, it seems to be, you know, meat fat, cheese, something like that that's not, you know, a bagel, because that'll be depleted fast, where the fat and the other one will, you know, hang in there for a while. So enough going off track. How important, you talk about a person's preferences in all of this. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, preferences is a tricky word because it has a technical meaning in economics. But all I really mean is the following, is that, you know, again, you have these modules in your head, and they're designed to bring about certain kinds of outcomes. So you have a hunger system, which is designed to get you the right amount of calories. You have social systems, which are designed to, you know, build friendship networks and make yourself popular and so forth. So I think of preferences as really things that adhere to modules as opposed to whole people. And the reason I think this is important is that, you know, there's all this work in economics and so on where you can show that people's preferences under certain circumstances appear to be intransient. They reverse themselves. So I sort of think about it as modules having preferences, things that they're trying to bring about. And again, from an evolutionary view, you can figure out why. Because, you know, organisms that had modules that caused certain states of affairs, you know, seek out food and mates and friends and so on, had an advantage relative to individuals who didn't have modules that sought to bring about those consequences.
You were just talking about friends, and I love something else you wrote. You say that you think the value of friendship jealousy is underrated. You give the example of the show I used to love, Boston Legal, of Alan Shore and Denny Crane, of their friendship. They were two men who were very close friends, and one being jealous that another one was, you know, being involved in a friendly way with somebody else.
I think that that's one of, you know, most delightful relationships in television. I just found that relationship just beautiful, and the particular sequence you're talking about, I thought really did show this, and it illustrates, you know, just like all great art does, it shows in a very elegant way this important part of human nature. That is, you know, if your theory of friendship is just something like, well, friends are people who we exchange with, and so all I really want is to have friends who have the kinds of things that I want, then you can't really understand friendship jealousy, you know, because why, if, you know, if you're my friend and I have another friend, why do I care if all I get from my friendships are some sort of exchanges, why do I care if you have another friend? But once you start thinking about friends as allies, as individuals who are going to take your side when conflicts arise, then your friends' friends are not necessarily always going to be good for you, because those are people who might wind up being on your friend's side instead of taking yours. And so I think that's a really important thing that is actually under research, friendship jealousy. You see a little bit of it in the literature on, you know, adolescence, because that's where the friendship jealousies tend to, you know, make for the best sitcoms, I guess.
And once again, I think that this evolutionary view of friends as allies, it's very important. People minimize evolutionary psychology and they like to attack it and everything. But I think if we look back and we understand what the environment we evolved in was and how important it would be, because you're seeing the same people only, and it was very life and death back in, you know, the Pleistocene when we evolved mainly, you know, that was such an important thing. If you understand that we're still driven by that brain, by that psychology essentially, then you can maybe understand more about how to work your friendships and how to work, build coalitions and community, which I think, you know, community is really underrated now, you know, when we're like most in need of it, when we're so spread apart.
Right. I definitely would agree with you on both those counts. First of all, the utility of the evolutionary approach for really understanding and therefore helping us with human behavior, but then also the sort of more applied issue, which is that our friendship networks are strange, which is why I'm so looking forward to your next book, because, you know, I do think that the idea that, you know, we're living in this world in which we don't really know our neighbors, but we do sort of keep in contact with our Facebook friends who aren't nearby, such an interesting world to live in. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I'm happy to be living in an age in which the technology makes so many things so exciting and interesting, including awesome special effects, and you're part of the world, right? But it does pose these challenges, right? So what do you do with a mind that evolved for a world in which interactions are face-to-face, and yet so much of what we do now is, you know, we have three people in a room, all relatively close friends, and half the time they're all just talking on their cell phones or updating their Facebook status or tweeting. What does that do to social relationships? I don't know.
Right. I mean, it's just a brave new world all of a sudden, and this is stuff that I deal with in the book. I should do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science, and tonight's brain belongs to evolutionary psychologist Dr. Robert Kurzban. He's the author of Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite, Evolution in the Modular Mind, and there's still a few minutes left. You can call in to comment, ask for advice, or ask a question, 347-326-9761. Just getting back to self-presentation, you write that Tubi and Cosmetis, who are big evolutionary psychologists, they talk about cultivating skills that make you uniquely valuable and irreplaceable as a friend. You know, so on one hand, we can do that. But then, you know, on the other hand, we need to read through others' glossy self-presentation. And how do we do that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that, you know, in many ways, we're all in this world in which we're playing games with each other, each one of us trying to display the kinds of traits, abilities, skills, and so on that make us uniquely valuable so others will value us. You know, you can sort of see this made explicit in the current online environment with things like clout scores, the number of followers you have, and so on, is that, you know, people are constantly trying to, you know, bring about literally followers in some sense. That is to say, people who are interested in what they think, what they have to say. And, you know, it's a zero-sum game to a large extent, right? There's only a certain amount of attention that we have, and there's only a certain amount of close friendship time that we have. And so we're all trying to be everyone else's best friend. And in order to be, you know, valuable, you have to have the kinds of things that other people value, that the things that make you an interesting, important person. And so, you know, I think that we sometimes lose sight of the fact that there's all this zero-sumness, that is to say, this my gain is your loss, right? If we're all competing for attention, then to some extent at least, there's going to be tension among us. And I think this is, of course, the reason that you have so many kinds of conflicts, because there's real resources at stake. Friendships are real things that we all compete over.
Right, and actually one thing that you write about, I would say fame, as you say, believability, I would say gullibility, and that's really important to recognize, you know, that when we're prone to believe people, you know, because they're famous or maybe because on low level they're popular, that we want to believe that what they're saying is true. Positive illusions you write about.
Right, I think that's true. I mean, one of the really interesting things, and some of my friends in anthropology have talked a little bit about this, is that once you have high prestige, you tend to be viewed as an expert on a range of topics, even though it's not the reason for your expertise, right? So you have basketball players selling underwear, right? Even though they didn't become a great basketball player by being good at choosing underwear. But the advertising industry recruits this, right? So they use famous people's opinions about seemingly unrelated products, because it's actually true, I think, that when you have high-prestige individuals, you tend to think that what they have to say is more interesting, more important, and possibly more accurate. And this is a really interesting facet, I think, of the human mind, the degree to which the according of status to another individual changes all these sorts of inferences you make about what it is they're saying and what it is.
Very, very interesting. I wanted to ask you, we just have a couple minutes left, about a topic that you're very interested in, I am, moralistic punishment. What is moralistic punishment, and how do our modules work on us there?
So moralistic punishment refers to the idea that costs are imposed on people who, you know, break a rule. So whether it's sort of crossing the street against the light or theft or murder, across human societies, there are ways in which people who break rules are punished. And sometimes that's by a justice system or the state, and then sometimes it's just by ostracism or by informal sanctions by a community. But it's a universal feature of humankind that we understand that when people violate some mutually recognized moral rule, that person's going to have costs imposed on them by someone. And I think that we have these moralistic modules in our head which are constantly searching for cases in which people have done one of these bad things, that is something that violated a rule, and, you know, behaves in such a way that facilitates their punishment, whether by pointing it out or by drawing attention to it or, punishing oneself. And, again, this is a really interesting part of human nature because, by and large, if you look across the non-human animal world, people, you know, other organisms, they don't impose costs on organisms that haven't harmed them or their allies. So, you know, chimps take revenge, but they don't impose a kind of moralistic punishment. They don't punish other chimps for violating the rule. So they harm chimps for having violated themselves. And this is one of the things that's so interesting about humans, is that we care about the various rule violations that people have done, even if we ourselves have not been harmed.
Right, I see it as sort of an inner accountant, you know, that sort of a general accountant for the company. It's kind of amazing. We're almost out of time. I would just like to ask you for a final piece of advice on how to live with these modular minds of ours.
Well, I think that's a great question, and I'll just tell you the sort of advice I gave myself, which is you know, we're all going to be hypocritical. We're all going to do things that are inconsistent with our stated values and our stated moral views. And the first thing is just to be aware of it, to recognize that that's going to happen and maybe be more alert for it. But the second thing is, to go back to the public service announcement you made about the fur you're discussing, is that, you know, one way to not be a hypocrite, not to condemn the things that you do, is to condemn fewer things. And I think the lesson there is that, you know, we all have these moralistic minds, and so one way to avoid hypocrisy is to maybe be a little less critical of other people's choices in terms of their behavior. That is, if you don't condemn something for being wrong, then you can't really be, at least in my terminology, a hypocrite about it. So the take-home lesson is to be aware that we condemn people all the time, and the less condemning you do, the less likely you are to be an inconsistent condemner.
Very, very interesting. Dr. Robert Kurzban, thank you so much for being with us from the town of the Philadelphia Cheesesteak at State University, where you're a professor. Pick up his book, Why Everyone Else is a Hypocrite, Evolution and the Modular Mind. Thank you so much, and everybody join us next week.
Thank you.